Okay. Thought I'd follow Chuck's example and scribble on the board for a while. I want to list a number of people. Aaron Bonning, Dave Nielsen, and Pedro Marinetti. If I write it like that, you can't tell if I spell it right or not. And then elliptic solvers, most of the work to date has been on a multigrid, which I'll show you just a bit about, which is Scott Hawley. And Aaron is has been working with the group in Meudon on pseudospectral solvers. And then what I'm going to show some about is constrained evolution, and that's Matt Anderson, who is a person who's most involved in that. So Aaron and Matt are students. Scott is a postdoc at Texas. So in view of the fact that these things always run over, I thought that what I ought to do is to just say the following sentence and then throw it open to questions. We have strong evidence that constrained evolution works. However, nobody asked a question.
What's the evidence?
What's the evidence? Okay, thank you. So, first of all, I want to show you something about the usual G dot K dot form, which means that the spatial evolution, and I'm talking about black hole space times, the spatial evolution is these equations. Those are the old, untrustworthy, unreliable ADM equations. So, what we're doing is we're dealing with those equations, and of course, there are, we all know what the constraint equations and the evolution equations look like in that form. If you just write them out, since we're using G dot and K dot, the only one that no one can remember is the K dot equation. No one includes me. That's why I'm writing it out. And there are two things that this group of people have been working on having to do with solutions to these equations. First thing is that there is a substantial amount of work in the literature on the effect of doing constraint subtraction from this set of equations. And it has been done for BSSN by the group at NCSA. It's been done for a class of hyperbolic schemes by the group at Cornell. In both cases, they get substantially long evolutions of those equations for single isolated black holes. It's also been studied by the group at Caltech, and the thing to note is that it's generally true that the subtractions that you have to do are problem dependent. The classic example is something that...
what do you mean by constraint subtraction?
I'm going to show you right now, okay? Suppose I did this. Etc. I mean, you can. There are studies, in fact, by Shinkei of possible subtractions from the equations. He's done, in fact, a study of these equations subtracted and a number of other formalisms subtracted. And what you find, there are analytic studies that say that, you know, some particular coefficient here, initially at least, stabilizes the system. You can study linear evolutions from some solutions. But what I was going to say is that you typically find that these coefficients are functions of the problem. So the example is the situation in flat space where the Rindler wedge has a dramatically different subtraction scheme to stabilize it. So there are two things to say. One is that this property of being able to stabilize things is not just a property of the more hyperbolic schemes. The hyperbolic schemes are the BSSN scheme, which is a form of a hyperbolic scheme. But you can actually do it just by subtracting off of these equations. In the examples that we run, we don't test for extremely long times. And as a caveat emptor, I have to say that the two groups that I referred to, the Illinois and the Cornell group, they run things for thousands, 10,000, say, to verify this. We don't usually run that long, so I can't actually completely justify this, you know, for infinite, arbitrarily long times. And we all know that there can be late time instabilities. So that is one point that I want to make, and I'll show you a graph to demonstrate that in just a second. The reason I have to do that is because of the way I set up my graphs here. I apologize for that. Now, the second aspect of the talk, though, the thing that I consider a lot more interesting, is the fact that we've started to look at the G dot K dot equation. Equations without any constraint subtraction at all, but solving constraints. So let me outline how this scheme works. It's really it's interesting in the following sense. It doesn't force you to make any gauge choices. It's distinct from what is called completely constrained by Perron and by Matt Chopwick. In the completely constrained case, you have to select out which are the dynamical variables in some explicit way, and you then have to solve for the other variables by gauge conditions and by the constraint equation. So it's got a tight structure built into it initially. Our method is the following. We solve initial data for multiple, single or multiple black holes. We then use a straightforward implementation of these two equations. We then impose the constraint equations also on top of this. So how do we do this? The method, let me go ahead and say again that the method doesn't require you to use any particular class of data. It doesn't require any particular class of gauge. This is three-dimensional, and we're doing it in rectangular coordinates. So we're trying to solve that full problem. So the method is really straightforward. I have data on some slice at time t0. I have some quality, one presumes, free evolution scheme that takes me up to t0 plus delta t. I now have an extrinsic curvature and a metric on that new slice. The point of the method is to take advantage of the fact that we already have quality initial data solvers that will work on general metrics and general extrinsic curvatures. So we view these two as trial functions for an elliptic solve on that slice. And so The metric that we actually get on that slice is G twiddle. The K that we actually get on that slice, the traceless K that we actually get on that slice is, isn't this phi squared? I can never remember. Okay, I'll get to that. Oh, well, I'll tell you. Okay. So we have an excision in here. So those are the equations, okay? So, right. They're not equations without boundary conditions. This isn't physics without boundary conditions. So we have excisions and we have outer boundaries. The boundary conditions for everything are, we have to understand a little bit about how these things go. We expect that phi would go out at the outer boundary. If this were not close to a solution, then phi would presumably go like 1 plus something over r at the outer boundary. And this w, which is the thing you solve for in the momentum constraint, this is a vector. Lw is a differential operator on w that gives it another index. It has fall-offs that you can investigate, and it goes like different components go differently. I believe it's 1 over r and 1 over I squared, but it might be r squared and r cubed. The boundary conditions that we use for this scheme are inner and outer boundaries. Yeah. So the boundary conditions for the elliptic solvers are really simple. Okay. Now, the boundary conditions for the evolution scheme are different. We have, for the evolution scheme, we have some sort of, at the moment, Dirichlet boundaries here. And here, we don't have a boundary. It's an excision boundary, and so we have a copy scheme that copies in to fill in the excision region. So that's the scheme.
Richard, yeah. What do you use for the trace of the extrinsic curvature?
The trace of the extrinsic curvature is whatever it is. It evolves. It doesn't change. So the way these elliptic, the York procedure works is that the trace is, it's a free given function that you don't change when you do the solve. So K, the trace of the extrinsic curvature, is just copied over. It's just the same as you got by this evolution.
Okay, so we start with some constraint in the equation.
Yeah.
You're
yeah.
getting all the constraints. So
yeah.
You're predicting.
That's right.
How in the world do I know that you're predicting, right?
You're supposed to wait until after I'm through to ask me that. I'll tell you the answer. Since we've known each other for such a long time, okay? The answer. The answer is convergence. Okay, this is a scheme which we've actually demonstrated. Matt has done a couple of runs that demonstrate that this scheme is second order, which is at least which is what it's supposed to be. The scheme itself has got a variable order, and we have to be careful about how to handle that. But anyway, convergence is the answer, right?
It's convergence, self-convergence.
Self-convergence, sure.
So the principle, I can imagine choosing phi in a perverse way that would bring it from Schwarzschild to Minkowski and still have it converged.
No, you couldn't. No.
Yeah, but if I'm at isotropic coordinates and I choose phi to be one over the phi.
You don't get to choose phi. You don't.
You're choosing phi equal one at any boundary. That's what I'm saying. I mean, one
so you're saying if I put in phi being, I could map Schwarzschild to flat, sure, but that isn't what I'm doing. I'm doing an infinitesimal change, right? I can't converge from Schwarzschild to flat space. That's a finite jump.
Depends what you're continuing the equation, so. If you want convergence, you make sure that you have continuing equations. It's not clear what they are, possibly.
Well, the continuum equations are the Einstein set.
Yeah, but they're the boundary conditions. It's not obvious like that. I have the evolution equations,
yeah.
And I agree that if I just put the convergence of that, I'll get more continuum Einstein equation. But then you evolve and then you change the data here. But the evolution equations are not what I had before. It's not obvious to me that I'm just repeating everything else I said.
Right. It's not obvious to me that that could possibly be true because they converge. If you, I will accept.
It does not have to converge to any solution at all.
Well, it converges to a solution, but not a solution that you get from the initial data.
Well, okay. So I mean, we have this problem in terms. We have this problem in terms of any kind of evolution scheme. If it's not constrained. You plot something like the Hamiltonian constraint, what you find is it does that. Okay? I'll show you some graphs. I only have a couple, unfortunately, right? That if I do this, what it does is that. Now, if you think that this free evolution scheme is converging to the solution of the equations, and I have something that lays on top of that, I find it hard to see how, you know? Okay. But sure, right. I agree.
One-linear control, so that's not really a fair test.
Well, as a matter of fact, I do have a couple of other graphs, but you're quite right. Okay, so unfortunately, this is preliminary, so I can't answer all possible questions. But I'd like to talk to you some more about the conversion question, because I really don't see how this cannot be true, right?
There's some standard apples with apples tests that check convergence against exact solutions.
Well.
Answer these questions with your Ramanujan test.
It does converge to exact solutions when we have exact solutions.
Run the Gauli wave?
No, we have run three-dimensional things, so it converges to Schwarzschild.
Well,
that's one of them, right?
But in the Gauli case, you don't have the Gauli, you do, but you don't have the excision
model. But you should be able to do this test and just see if this method of projecting back to the constraint hypersurface.
Is that how many minutes I have, Ina?
Oh, no. Yeah, I was going to ask, is it possible for you to numerically compute the four-dimensional Einstein tensor in your solution?
Well, we do. I mean, what's the question? Of course, we do, because it's zero, because the constraints are solved and the evolution equations are solved.
But
I'll show you some residuals, right? Okay, so there are various things about this, and maybe, although obviously there are some questions. Well, we do. Well, okay. The codes that I'm going to show you do not have independent residual evaluators in them, but we have looked at that, and we're solving the equations. Okay. The fact that it converges to Schwarzschild is an example of... Okay, let's see if this works.
I think in solving this protocol, it's factoring the standard difference. The
direction
of the five. And that must be part of...
Well, okay. What that's doing is saying that in one step of the evolution, we're actually not making large errors. However, we're not actually correcting errors that arise from the evolution at those points. So we're accepting whatever that is, right? There's not a solve there. It's a boundary condition. Okay. Not, you know, this is a scheme. It's unfortunately not. Going to stay up, down. Let's see what happens here. First thing I want to show you is some results work done with Scott Hawley. Let's see, I have to do that too. Which is a multigrid solve. And this is a model equation. What this equation looks like is the trace k equals zero Hamiltonian constraint. Exactly. It is the trace k equals zero Hamiltonian constraint. To us, that's a model equation. It's a single uncoupled equation. This is a multigrid solve with a domain cut out of it, which is spherical, which is chosen so that it doesn't hit any of the grids. Okay. And this is the relative truncation error with comparing different levels of the multigrid. And this is exactly second order convergence. Each of those is scaled by the factor it would have to be. It's second-order convergence. This is kind of remarkable because in the past, some people have had trouble with multigrid solves with holes, but it appears to be under control.
What's on your
hand? That's it's R, right?
Oh.
Center of the hole is here. That's the horizon or Schwarzschild hole. The excision is 1.29, I think, M. See if I can get this other one to come up. Oh. Yes. So here are a couple of transparencies of what you can do with constraint subtraction for the G dot K dot equations. And there's a particular constraint subtraction here. Read it to you. It's 0.232 multiplied by H and Gij and 0.18 multiplied by H from Kij.
This is constraint subtraction and electrophilicity?
No, this is just constraint subtraction, okay? Now, this is actually, if you go and look through Shinkai's paper, it's not in there. Even this form isn't in there, where you subtract both something proportional to G and something proportional to K from Shinkai's list of possible subtractions. He didn't consider that one. But anyway, you can see what happens. And this is the constraint subtracted solution. And you're right, this is the Hamiltonian constraint, right? And it's a constraint subtracted solution. It just stays flat. This is the early part of the evolution. It runs out to 1,000 m or so. A good point. Yeah, this is Kirschild analytic Lapson shift. And this is another one we did, which is higher resolution. It has the same constraint subtraction, and it behaves similarly. So those are two Schwarzschild black hole cases with excision with analytic Kirschild Lapson shift. And notice that there's some jiggling around in there. We also have Dirichlet outer boundary conditions, and so there is stuff that rattles around in the box as the evolution proceeds. The method is a method of lines, which has a variable time step size. It's a solver called sundials. Okay. Now, then we have few examples of this. The excision is an extrapolation, which is second order, 2 points in. And then here's an example of solving constraints. This is a moderately small box, a Schwarzschild black hole. This is the unconstrained evolution, and the constrained evolution goes on for a couple of hundred m. That's as far as we've run this one so far. And this is the very early time, and you can see they track very closely at the very early time, and then the unconstrained one shows a little less violation, and then it shoots off to infinity.
The constraint solver is at every delta t, or every...
Okay, let me talk about that. The constraint solver is a conjugate gradient solver that is in PETSI. Okay, it's a GM res solver. And we have this high order time step for the integration, the evolution step. So the number, the order of steps that you're taking in the time evolution is determined by that solver, not by us. Okay, but every time that thing returns, then we do a constraint solve. Okay, and so that's the answer to that. Now, we have been running on the computer at Texas, which is a very nice Power 4 from IBM, and it has about a third of a teraflop of performance. It is heavily used, and so we tend to get bogged down in queues, and it certainly is no better at any NSF source. So we're sort of backed up on the runs we want to test this on, but this is extremely encouraging. Now, what I want to show you next actually is maybe more interesting, and that's the following. This is a pair of black holes, Schwarzschild black holes boosted toward one another at 0.5. They're going to collide at t equals 8m. This is 5m, so they move for a while. And this is a picture of the unconstrained and the constrained evolution after 5m of evolution. And, so I never did say the point I was trying to make. Why is there any constraint violation at all? This is a Hamiltonian constraint. The answer is that we're not trying to solve the constraints down to epsilon. What we're doing is we set a parameter that solves the constraints down, so that the residuals in the elliptic solve are smaller than but comparable to our estimate of the truncation error. We're not, so that means that when we solve these things, we solve them very lightly, a few iterations, and that means that the overhead for doing this is only about 30%. So it is not a big overhead on running the code. And because of that, though, an unconstrained evolution that's not in trouble will have comparable constraint violation to a constrained evolution, because we're telling the constrained evolution to only solve down roughly to what the truncation error is anyway.
Richard, is this the Hamiltonian or the normalized Hamiltonian?
This is the Hamiltonian, and I was going to say that there's no normalization here at all. I don't know what those numbers mean. Okay. But what you can tell is that the red one, which is the unconstrained case, is actually bigger and it has bigger jags in it. The black one, which is the constrained case, is a lot smoother and cleaner. And you can see that these numbers are comparable, although they're a little smaller in the constrained case. And this head-on collision has been run past collision. And this is what happens to the evolution after the collision. So the collision occurred at 8m. That's 8. So they look at the previous graph, and it was way up here. After the collision, we excise a bigger region, so we get rid of a lot of the trashy stuff. And the constrained evolution is much better. This trend upward is not completely encouraging, but it's certainly much better than what it does in the unconstrained case. And even better than that, if you take a look at this, if you could see these little label numbers on here, you would see that this thing has got this excursion in the middle of the box. If you could see the numbers on here, you would see that all the numbers you can see except the ones right at the boundary say zero. That is, this is the zero contour, and so is that. There's some little wiggle one direction or the other between those two contours, but there's basically no constraint violation in the middle of the domain. So, yeah, I agree. There are lots of things that we have to understand both numerically and analytically, but this seems to be a really substantial improvement. It shows that you can get away with the simplest and lowest number of variables, that is the g.k.dot equations. Oh, I should say, this has constraint subtraction, but it doesn't matter. It just happened to be turned on when we did the run. And it takes sufficiently long to do the run, so we haven't done it again. Okay, well, thanks. Yeah.
I agree that there is a bit of possible doubt about whether your constraint solution is actually the solution you want looking for. I think unless you have a theory, you can't really rule that out. But you have two things to play with here, right? One is the error at which you would solve your constraints. The other one is how often you do that. Are you in control of these two parameters? In other words, can you show me that if you reduce your error in the constraint solution, or you will increase the frequency in which you solve the constraints, things get better? In other words,
I can do the converse. I can show you that if I increase the error or reduce the number of constraint solves, it get worse. The ones I show you, of course, are the best ones we've done. But there's no way that the evolution is going to get better than the truncation error in the evolution equations by pushing down on constraints. Yeah? Yeah.
How sensitive to those numbers?
You need about 3 decimals to get an unconstrained but constrained solved black hole to run for a very long time.
So how did you get those?
Matt Anderson did a search and zeroed in on them. It's a binary search done by Wetware. Yes, they are. They are problem dependent. That's the trouble. So it's not a solution. It's not a solution to the global problem. For a particular example, you can get a very long evolution by doing this. It's really strange because it doesn't seem to be critical in the sense of a critical phenomenon. You don't need 10 digits, but you need several digits.
Well, have you measured the lifetime as a function of those? Maybe you could.
Well, if you start fiddling with this, like putting another decimal on it, you get smooth and slow changes to the lifetime. So I don't know. I mean, I'm not. If it's critical, it's.
You're stopping it before things blow up.
Well, true. You're quite true. You're quite right, because we don't run them forever.
Do you think there's any point in doing constraint subtraction?
No.
So you could just turn that off.
Yeah. Basically. Yeah. The first example, the Schwarzschild solution didn't have any constraint.
What happens if you put the initial data, say, charge, you don't evolve? Now, if you have some truncation error in your solution, and you now solve the constraints equations, you get a phi that is identically water. You're going to get something.
We're not using the same solver for the evolution as we do typically for the initial data. If we use the same solver, we get one.
My question is, if you get a perfect evolution, it brings your initial data to the next same here. Now you resolve.
You get one.
You get a different file.
No, you get one. If you're using the same solver.
Is there a way of actually getting the... looking at the outer boundary, for example, and seeing if, in fact, the time-like constraint equation is satisfied here. I mean, it's another check.
That's another thing that I'm trying to implement, but we haven't got it going. Yeah.
I'm a little just what it means. I mean, you plot Hamiltonian constraint error when you're
sure.
Yeah. Constraint. It's not obvious what that really means.
Well. What it definitely shows that you're not, that the solution is not blowing up. That's the only thing we can say it means. And the single black hole, the one there, looks like a single black hole. It doesn't change. Now, because of the way this solver works, we don't get this exponential convergence to machine precision, because the solver is always fiddling with things, and so we have a sort of stochastic jiggling in.
In fact, you have some sort of given attributes to the solver. I mean, it's not surprising that you have a Hamiltonian constraint.
Yeah. So you look at something else. But if it looks flat and you have a Schwarzschild solution, then...
Well, the other thing you could do is to plot the residuals of all the evolution equations, right, which are going to be mostly non-zero as well.
Right.
And those will probably be at the same level
Well, they are. I mean, the thing is, they are. If we get
the
one,
that was. Why you're evolving under Lachin's jumps? People somehow always think the constraints are somehow a little bit more special.
Lachin jumps when you project back down on.
No.
So okay. So let me say something about projection. If you go and look at the MHD literature, and in fact, I talked to Lee about this too, and I think Lee suggested a way to do it in the GR case. If you look at the MHD literature, you see that the projection is in fact a motion from the solution you evolved to the nearest del dot B solution in a least squares sense. So there's yet another way in which this thing has an obvious convergence to the solution you're trying to get. So I don't know. I mean, I agree one should have theorems about this, right? But since I do a lot of numerical stuff, I consider an example a proof. You know, it's an existence proof. Sorry.
No more questions.
Thanks. Good luck there, Bernie.